Lovely day, yeah? Okay, I'm going to talk a little bit about mindfulness, and then we'll sit. So mindfulness has taken on a lot of different meanings as it has become culturally popular. And a lot of traditional meditation teachers are kind of chagrined about that. I'm not, in that I think it's really great that people are trying to become more aware and self-controlled. But I do want to point out the difference between kind of the most common understanding of mindfulness and the way that, and the profundity of mindfulness. So the most common understanding of mindfulness is it's paying attention. So in the popular culture, when they teach mindfulness, they teach people to pay attention to what they're doing and what they're thinking and what they're feeling, and that's great. Because then people realize that they're doing, thinking, and feeling stuff that they could do better at. But really what that is it's reorienting the thought process. It's saying, think about what you're doing. Okay? So you stay on this level. You change your... You change the weather around something. So instead of thinking all the time about what just happened, you start to think about, well, what's happening now? You reorient the thoughts. That's not difficult to do. And it's why a lot of people, why the culture has accepted it, because it's not very hard. But the more profound level of mindfulness is. Not that it's difficult, it's that it takes significant practice. How do I explain? When we're sitting, first of all, in the 10 minutes that we sit, it may not be possible to go to this more profound level. And when you're beginning a practice of mindfulness, it may not be available to you at all. It takes some time during each sitting, and it takes a lot of practice in sitting to reliably become the sky rather than the weather. So when we sit, the first instruction is to find your breathing. Just keep coming back to your breathing, and that even three-year-olds can do. Although none of us can do it well, in that we go to our breathing and then we're lost in thought again. We go to our breathing, we're lost in thought again. You know, and you do that about a trillion times. But with practice, it becomes easier to stay with the breathing most of the time, or at least some of the time. Don't forget to sign in. Who knew I was going to turn into a nudge?
You're human. It's okay. You're human and you're alive.
It was either that or the gorilla. It was better than the gorilla at the door when I took this on, you know. Okay. So with a little practice, you can stay with your breathing. And then the second instruction is to let yourself soften and open. And that's pretty available to the culture. Most folks, they realize they're holding tension in their shoulders, or they're worried about something, or they've got some tension in the body, and they kind of let that open up. And that's where most of the measurable health benefits come from, is the releasing of physical tension. But then the third instruction, so the first is breathing, the second is soften and open. Easy so far. The third is notice what's happening. And typically, where attention goes, thought goes also. They're married in our typical experience. That is, the minute you hear a sound, you think that's a car. And the minute that you feel an itch, you think that's an itch. So there is always thought accompanying attention. So when people are first paying attention to stuff, they're paying attention to the thought, and they're thinking about the thought, and then they're paying attention to their breathing, and they're thinking about the breathing. So the breathing, the thinking is always going with attention. It isn't until some point later in the practice that attention doesn't go with thought, or thought doesn't go with attention. Attention moves, and thought doesn't necessarily move with it.
So let's say we're here. We're just come sit. So now we're feeling our breathing, and we're letting ourselves soften and open. And our attention moves to a thought. And instead of thinking about that thought, we stay with the breathing and the open attention, and we just notice the thought happening in our head, either verbally or visually. And we stay with the breathing, and then we notice another thought happening in our head. We stay with the breathing, and then we get lost in the thought. We come back to the breathing, and we just are open awareness, and we notice a feeling. Oh. And then we notice a thought. And then we notice a sensation. And then we're noticing how attention is moving, like a searchlight, from thing to thing to thing. There's that. And so we're watching the searchlight move. So we're not just paying attention. That's what the searchlight illuminates. We're paying attention to attention. We're paying attention to the movement of the searchlight as the searchlight illuminates different things. We're watching our attention move. We're paying attention to attention, as well as to what attention illuminates. That's the more profound level. And so when we're at that level, then it's like we're two people, or we're two yous, or it's not really true. We're at two levels. The level of me that we've always been is this level. Thoughts, feelings, and sensations. Is this another me? So now we're here, we've moved to here. Is this another individual identity? So we begin to spend less time preoccupied by this stuff, because we've heard it all before and seen it all before so many times. How many times do you worry about the same thing, you know? So this stuff becomes less interesting, so more of our attention goes to the attentional process itself. What is this attention that keeps going to these things? And what we discover when we're just open attention is that everything that we experience is some kind of putting together of attention. It's some kind of construction of attention. And it doesn't exist until that the attention is put together in a certain way, until consciousness is cathected, I guess is the right word, stuck together. So here's open attention with absolutely no phenomena. None of it. There's just a potential for experience. And then there's a thought. And that's consciousness made into something. And then that goes away, and there's just openness. And then there's another thought, and that's consciousness recollected. So the question is, where is the world and where are you? And the world is a collection of consciousness events. a sound. And first there's a sensation, and then there's a thought about it, that's a bird. And that's when the world comes into existence. When consciousness makes itself into something. And how about you? When do you come into existence? I think you will find that you come into existence when you think. When there's just awareness, there's no you. But the minute you think, oh, this is awareness, then there's a me having awareness. So the more profound level of mindfulness is a realization of how we moment by moment construct an identity and a world from whatever this sentience is, whatever this awareness is. And the reason I'm expatiating, I use the word too much now, expatiating means speak at length. The reason I'm expatiating about this, I'm trying to learn new words, and so I'm sticking in this word, is like using it all the time, because I expatiate too much. It's not a bad word. In any event, the reason I'm going on in great length about this is because it's leaning into what we're going to do today. So I want you to experientially, to some extent, understand this before we hear all this profound wisdom about the basic nature of reality. Because that's what we're going to do today. You kind of didn't get there last time, so I thought I would kick it up a notch or seven. We pointed last time toward it, but we didn't quite get there. Okay, so a question, and then we'll sit, and then we'll listen to what sages say.
When Descartes said, "I think therefore I am," is that what he meant?
He was right, actually. Descartes was wrong about a lot of stuff, or controversial about a lot of stuff, but he was right about that. We come into being when we use thought in a certain way. Well, whether we use thought at all. Yeah. He was right. So I'm going to close the door, yeah?
I guess that's what you did. Mm-hmm.
All right, so the way not to understand what I just told you, okay? The way not to have this realization is to try to have this realization. That will not work. That will generate a lot of activity in your mind, okay? The way to have this realization is just to do the practice. And at a certain point, so you're just breathing, you're letting yourself soften and open, you're just coming back to your breath, and you notice that you get sucked into thought, and you come back to your breath. And then you hear something, and then you come back to your breath. And then after a while, you can watch these various things happening without getting sucked into them. You know? And that'll just emerge. And then after a while, you'll realize that everything that's all the phenomena, everything that's happening, all your experience is happening at that level that you're watching. And you'll become curious about the watching itself. And then when you start to think about it, then you go into thought again, and then you have to come back to your breathing. Okay. So all you're doing is breathing, softening and opening, and noticing what happens. And all these profound insights emerge spontaneously. But if you go hunting for the witnessing perspective, which is what I'm talking about, you will definitely chase it away. Because any effort will be something here rather than that. Okay, so the alpha and omega instruction is just find your breathing. And the second instruction is just let everything open, soft. So we'll sit for 10 minutes.
Everything you just experienced, everything you just experienced was made out of the same thing. It was all your awareness, right? Whatever it was, you were aware of. Your experience was your awareness at that moment. Your awareness changes in its flavor from moment to moment, but it's always the awareness that you're aware of. But what about the world outside that? We have no way of knowing if that exists, because the only way we know about it is through our awareness. And so it's an assumption that outside of our awareness there is something coming into our awareness. But that's part of our awareness. That's a thought in our mind. It's a construction in our mind. So the only thing we can be sure of is that there is this consciousness, this awareness. And everything else is a mental set of assumptions. Abraham.
Yeah, what do you think of the expression that says our physical world is a collection of a frozen thought?
It's a collection of frozen thoughts. What I just said is that, but I don't know. I don't know if there's a physical world outside the awareness that I have. I have been taught that that's the case. I presume that's the case. My nervous system wants me to believe that's the case. But I have no way of knowing if that's the case. In fact, so it seems as though there is a physical world outside my thoughts. Most people would agree that that is the case, but what I'm about to introduce you to is a set of understandings which say that that way that we look at things is we have a consciousness and outside of it there's reality. That's not true, is what these people say. That's an illusion. That's a level of assumption that we make that is not the basis of reality. So yeah, from the point of view of we're gonna look at a minute. So let's not get lost in philosophical debate. Let's let somebody else lose us in philosophical debate. So maybe some of this will intellectually make sense anyway. But what you might have experienced in that 11 minutes that we sat was that after a while, it became clear that stuff was just arising in your mind. There's a sound, there's a thought, there's the breathing. And there was a kind of a feeling of, okay, it's kind of all just mine. All right, so this is the book that Ron Gibbons gave to me some years ago, Awakening to the Dream, The Gift of Lucid Living by Leo Hartong. It's a book about non-dual awareness.
What's the title
again? Awakening to the Dream.
And who's
Leo Hartong, Hartong. And if anybody wants to borrow a copy, I have two copies, and I won't give the gift copy away, but I'll give the other copy away.
We've got to the announcements.
Oh, that's right.
Actually,
oh, darn. I have several announcements, and then I'll call on you, okay? I forgot.
Thank you, Julie.
Thank you, Julie. Okay, so here are the several announcements, very briefly. First, next week is the art fair. Bring your art. Bring it around. Bring it. Put it around the sides of the room. People will see it. Don't be afraid. Bring something, okay, if you wish. Second is next week is the last class of this term. Okay? We are going to have the same class, the same title of the class next fall because I can't change the title. You know, I always like to change the title, but I can't because the state has approved this title for, you know.
Is it still free?
So, yeah, we're free next fall, and it'll start in September, go 10 weeks. It'll be different material, but it'll still be the same title. We may If everything goes right, we will have a new projector. Because I have been getting at him for years, and finally it's going to happen, apparently. And if that's the case, I can show you extraordinary video that I have been banking for years, because this projector, you can hardly see anything, and I want to show you amazing stuff. So in the fall, maybe we'll have the opportunity to really have the media that I have been longing for. Okay, so announcements. Robert.
Yes, I really want to revitalize life stories. So I've done two things. I have written my own life story. Okay, so go to svt.org/Spencer. And the other thing I've done is I put my contact information there. So the idea is go there, it'll say contact Robert or something like that. And so write your own life story and email it to me at that address that you'll see there. And there's other examples that other people have done. So you get inspired to write your own. It could be a few paragraphs, it could be however long you want. It's free on the internet. Maybe you will be inspired.
Yeah, I actually did. I did write one, but it's not in this current book. So when the book's iterated, somehow it got lost. But I already have done, so I'll do another one.
Okay, well, yeah, just email to me. And the thing is that if you get inspired to update it, just email me again and I'll put the updated one.
Yeah, so it's the red book. Somebody can take it home this week and bring it back next week. It's also on SWT.org. But I brought the book home because somebody left it last week. They were supposed to take it. And I started reading some of this stuff, and it's fascinating. Carl has a great one in there. I learned so much about you.
but it's there all the time. It's there online.
Okay, so think, you don't have to write your life story. You can write anything you want. You can write a poem. You can write a snippet from your life. Just put a little, it'd be nice to get all our sounds in this symphony. Okay. Okay, so any other announcements real quick? Julie.
What are we going to talk about next week?
This week we're going above and we're going to the basis and the zenith. Next week we're coming back down to earth with a thud, and then we'll rise up. So next week is going to be the difficulties of life and the very shining hope for the future. But next week we come, this week again, if we ever get there, we're going to go above and below. And next week we're going to be firmly on the earth.
Will that be a reality or an illusion?
It's probably ultimately an illusion, but in terms of how we, the level at which we generally vibrate, it's pretty darn real. You know, there's stories about, you know, the Zen math, people saying, oh, I understand. Master, I understand now it's all illusion. And then the Zen master steps on your toe. Okay, here we go. Just a little bit from Awakening to the Dream. And then a much longer reading I have. So, I think I'll do this one. Let me try the mic so that I can read more easily.
Yep.
I keep not figuring it out. Okay, it goes like this, right? Yeah, that's not right. So can you, whoops, no, of course you can't. Can you hear me now?
No.
No?
Right on.
Yeah, it is on. Can you hear me now?
No.
That's what I thought. Okay.
Oh, you have to turn the other one on.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. Cool guy. Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
How about now? Is that a good volume?
Yeah.
Yeah?
That's your reading voice.
Is that a good volume?
Yeah.
Let me know. Okay, so. Okay. This coming home, I actually have a book called Coming Home. So they talk about this understanding as coming home. This coming home reveals the illusory nature of the ego, your sense of self, the world, time and space. All of this does not disappear in a blast of white light. By the way, it sometimes does, as you're about to hear. Okay. But what does disappear is the sense of separation that constitutes the ego illusion. Although it may put a glint in your eye as you delight in this cosmic illusion, there will actually be no you to delight in it, no you to see it, and no you to get it. The play, including your role in it, continues with the altered perspective of knowing, delighting, and seeing, without an individual claiming these as personal activities or achievements. What is left is that which appears as you. What is left is that which appears as you and everything. What is left is that which appears as you and everything, your true self, which is already and always awake to the dream of life. This realization happens by itself. No new knowledge is acquired, but old assumptions fall away. No effort in the world can make you what you already and actually are. The truth behind ego is a no-thingness too close for investigation, since it is the very source from which the attempt to investigate arises. Seeing this makes it clear that the activating agent in all your actions is not a fictional me. Okay, seeing this makes it clear that the activating agent in all of your actions is not a fictional me, but the universal energy, one's true self. The belief in a me, as well as the seeking for enlightenment, is seen through by no one as nothing but the playful activity of this primal activating energy. The cosmic joke in the journey of the seeker is that the energy that fuels the seeking is precisely what is being sought. In Zen, this is called riding an ox in search of the ox. Wu Wei Wu compares it to looking for your spectacles, not realizing that they're on your nose. And were you not looking through them, you wouldn't be able to see what you're looking for. It awakens to itself, or more to the point, it is awakeness itself. It awakens to itself, or more to the point, it is awakeness itself. It is the light in which all apparent opposites reveal their interdependence and ultimate oneness. It is the clarity in which the illusion of separateness dissolves. The witness and that which is witnessed merge into witnessing, while the illusion of past and future dissolves into the clarity of timeless presence. As it is, life has no meaning beyond itself. It is always at the point of completion and simultaneously as fresh as the morning dew at the dawn of creation. This awakeness does not deliver a permanent transcendent state. The belief that awakening is about such a state, that it is an experience for someone, constitutes the enlightenment myth. It continues the illusion of a separate seeker and keeps you trapped in the search for the desired awakening. That which you truly are is forever awake and present, not just in the extraordinary, but also in and as the ordinary. It is beyond simple and complex. It is the source of both. word.
Okay.
Got that?
You have a valley.
That's God with a sore throat. So, with that preamble, now I'm going to read you a little bit about how people come to experience this realization. This comes from the work of Stan Grof. This is the book, The Cosmic Game, which is a little-known book that he wrote, which is unbelievable. I've read portions of this to some of you before, so this might be something that some of this you've heard before. It could stand a second hearing. He, if you don't know about Stan Grof, he was one of the original psychedelic researchers, and he began to, and he started as a very straight psychiatrist, and he began to hear about these experiences that were very, very, very non-ordinary, and he decided to investigate them because he also, in his training, had some experiences himself that were kind of shattered his materialistic worldview. And so first he classified the psychedelic experiences, and then the question was, are these just drug dreams? Or has anybody else had such experiences? And then he went looking in the spiritual literature, and there in the spiritual literature are all these same experiences, and so he correlated them, and this book is a great correlation of these things. But these are not ordinary experiences. These are experiences that have been had by people who either take a strong psychedelic substance and have good karma, or who do major spiritual practice. So the way he writes about these at the beginning is kind of spectacular. That doesn't mean that if you practice your mindfulness for a few minutes every day, over the long term you're not going to come to the same understandings, but you might not come to them so suddenly. The problem with coming to them suddenly is if you're not prepared to integrate them, they can unbalance you, and they go away. And so a lot of people, as you know, like Ram Dass, a lot of people that initially had these insights using psychedelics decided that they didn't want to lose the insight and they didn't want to feel imbalanced, so they decided to do spiritual practice, and they now constitute the ranks of all the spiritual teachers. Well, not all of them, but many of them, where it started out by these kind of sudden insight. Windows opened and then closed, and so they decided they wanted to find the door. So, where do we start with this? So this is a little bit of Stan Grof writing about the two most common ways that people experience what they consider the ultimate level of reality. First, he starts this chapter, which is the third chapter, with a quote from the Katha Upanishad. What is soundless, touchless, formless, imperishable, likewise tasteless, constant, odorless, without beginning, without end, higher than the great, stable. By discerning that, one is liberated from the mouth of death. That's the beginning of this chapter. After we have had direct experiences of the spiritual dimensions of reality, the idea that the universe, life, and consciousness could have developed without the participation of superior creative intelligence appears to us absurd, naive, and untenable. So there's something intelligent basic in the universe, what he's saying. I therefore searched in the reports of the people with whom I had worked for states of consciousness that were perceived as reaching the ultimate frontiers of the human spirit. I was trying to find out what experiences would convey the sense of encountering the supreme principle in the universe. People who had an experience of the absolute, that fully satisfied their spiritual longing typically did not see any specific figurative images. When they felt they attained the goal of their mystical and philosophical quest, their descriptions of the supreme principle were highly abstract and strikingly similar. Those who reported such an ultimate revelation showed quite remarkable agreement in describing the experiential characteristics of this state. They reported that the experience of the supreme involved transcendence of all the limitations of the analytical mind, all rational categories, and all constraints of ordinary logic. That is, you can't figure this out. This experience, that's really hard if you're smart, because you're going to try at every point to understand what you're experiencing, and therefore banish the experience. And that, you know, Zen works with that by giving you things, impossible things to think about, so that finally you stop thinking about them because you exhaust your brain after 10 years. And at the moment that you exhaust your brain, you get an insight into what's underneath your thinking. Those are koans, you know, like what does your face look like before your mother and father conceived you, that kind of thing. This experience of ultimate reality was not bound by the usual categories of three-dimensional space and linear time, as we know them from everyday life. It also contained all conceivable polarities in an inseparable amalgam, and thus transcended dualities of any kind. Time after time, people compared the absolute to a radiant source of light of unimaginable intensity, though they emphasized that it also differed in some significant aspects from any forms of light that we know in the material world. To describe the absolute as light entirely misses some of its essential characteristics, particularly the fact that it is also an immense and unfathomable field of consciousness endowed with infinite intelligence and creative power. So I'll read that sentence again. To describe the absolute as light entirely misses some of its essential characteristics, particularly the fact that it is also an immense and unfathomable field of consciousness endowed with infinite intelligence and creative power. The supreme cosmic principle can be experienced in two different ways. Sometimes all personal boundaries dissolve or are drastically obliterated, and we completely merge with the divine source, becoming one with it and indistinguishable from it. Other times, we maintain the sense of separate identity, assuming the role of an astonished observer who is witnessing, as if from the outside, the mysterium tremendum of existence. Or, as some mystics, we might feel the ecstasy of an enraptured lover experiencing the encounter with the beloved. Spiritual literature of all ages abounds in descriptions of both types of experiences of the divine. I'll skip the next paragraph. What he's saying is you can either be merged with the one and obliterated into it, or you can be separate from and witnessing the basic mystery. The great Indian saint and mystic, Sri Ramana Maharshi, once exclaimed emphatically, "I want to taste sugar, not to become sugar." That's the one where you experience it rather than are it. People who have had the experience of the supreme principle people who have had the experience of the supreme principle know that they have encountered God. However, most of them feel that the term God does not adequately capture the depth of their experience, since it has been distorted, trivialized, and discredited by mainstream religions and cultures. Even names like absolute consciousness or universal mind that are often used to describe this experience seem to be hopelessly inadequate to convey the immensity and shattering impact of such an encounter. Some people consider silence to be the most appropriate reaction to the experience of the Absolute. For them, it is obvious that those who know do not speak, and those who speak do not know. The supreme principle, by the way, this is leading up to an actual experience which I'm going to read to you. The supreme principle can be directly experienced in holotropic states of consciousness, states which are open your consciousness to larger possibilities. But this supreme principle eludes any attempts at adequate description or explanation. The language that we use to communicate about matters of daily life simply is not adequate for this task. Individuals who have had this experience seem to agree that it is ineffable. Words and the structure of our language are painfully inappropriate tools to describe its nature and dimensions, particularly to those who have not had it. With all these reservations, I include the following report written by Robert, a 37-year-old psychiatrist, who in his session had the experience of what he considered to be the ultimate reality. I assume this is a psychedelic session that he's sitting. The beginning of the experience was very sudden and dramatic. I was hit by a cosmic thunderbolt of immense power that instantly shattered and dissolved my everyday reality. I completely lost contact with the surrounding world. It disappeared as if by magic. The awareness of my everyday existence, my life, and my name faintly echoed like dreamlike images on the far periphery of my consciousness. Robert, California, United States, planet Earth. I tried hard to remind myself of the existence of these realities, but they suddenly did not make any sense. Equally absent were any archetypal visions of deities, demons, and mythological domains that were so predominant in my previous experiences. At that time, my only reality was a mass of swirling energy of immense proportions that seemed to contain all of existence in an entirely abstract form. It had the brightness of myriads of suns, yet it was not on the same continuum with any light I knew from everyday life. It seemed to be pure consciousness, intelligence, and creative energy transcending all polarities. It was infinite and finite, divine and demonic, terrifying and ecstatic, creative and destructive, all of that and much more. I had no concept, no categories for what I was witnessing. I could not maintain a sense of separate existence in the face of such a force. My ordinary identity was shattered and dissolved. I became one with the source. Time lost any meaning whatsoever. In retrospect, I believe I must have experienced the Dharmakaya, the primary clear light, that according to the Tibetan Book of the Dead, the Bardo Thodol, appears at the moment of death. Before I keep reading, I want to interject that people have less spectacular but similar experiences, sometimes spontaneously. A friend of mine went to the Grand Canyon and had an experience of sitting and looking at the Grand Canyon, and suddenly her sense of self went away completely, and there was a feeling of oneness, and it lasted for a long time. It had no relevance to clock time. And she came back and said, I just experienced the ultimate reality. But it just came, it just happened. Maslow called this peak experience, right? And he said that some people have one and it changes their life, and some people have these kind of on a smaller level every day. There's a, a, a lessening of the ego boundary and sometimes a going away completely of the sense of separateness. Bernie, you want to?
Yes, why do you think that the human being has to study this to try to find it? Why is it not perhaps in us innately?
The question is, why do we have to study to find this? Why have we forgotten about this? And he actually talks about that in this book in some length, but supposedly animals have this, and infants, before they contract into a me, have this. But the supposedly the what he says in this book, like I can tell you what I read. Okay? What he said in this book is, it creates a cosmic drama. The one breaks itself up into the many, and the many forget they're the one, and then they have the experience of rediscovering by playing all the roles in the drama that they're actually the source of the drama. So the one, in order to be interested, creates a drama where it's the one forgets it's the one and becomes the many, and then the many, by playing all the roles in the drama, find their way back into the one. Okay, so that's his basic sketch of why we don't know who we are. Now, Alan Watts talks about it in other ways. Everybody talks about it in other ways. Okay, so a couple of comments, and then we'll go back, because there's another experience I want to give you, which is a different experience. So, first of all, what's your first name?
Me?
Yeah.
Shirley.
Shirley.
I wanted to know, why do we all try LSD?
Oh, okay. Now, it's a wonderful question. The answer to that question is, the question is, why don't we all just try LSD and get enlightened? Yeah, a lot of us tried, but most of us didn't get enlightened. What these substances do is they just manifest what's at deeper levels of your mind. And so most of us are not in the karmic position to open this completely. We open to where was a blockage from the opening. And so at the beginning, it's a lot of fun. And then after a while, we get to what is holding us back from going further. And then the work has to be done. And that's when people get off the train and say, you know, I'm going to do some psychotherapy and some spiritual practice for the rest of my life because this is a little heavy. There ain't no quick fix, okay? Some people have an experience. Some people have an experience at the beginning of an opening. No, some people have an experience of this opening at the beginning. It's an open window. And then they have to go back and do the work of opening the ego more completely. Many people who had psychedelic experiences had very revelatory experiences to begin with, but then when they went back to try it again, then they realized that that was a grace that gave them an indication of, it gave them motivation to continue. Many people are nodding their heads, you know, because you know, it ain't so simple. Robert.
I'll agree it ain't so simple, but there's a book called Tryptamine Palace, which describes a direct path that is not a psychedelic. And the guy in the book says, meditation is for people who don't have access to the right substances. And so there's a name for a new category of substance that is not psychedelic. It's called entheogen, and it comes from the same root as theology. Anyway, there's more to be said, but I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah, let's just leave it. This is a big debate, and I don't want to go there. Okay, because
it's too loud.
Okay, so I know because I'm yelling. All right, so another. When I come back to reading, I'll put this on again. So another comment or two, a question or two, and then we got to go. Okay, so we'll go here and here. Yeah, so go for it. Yeah.
When you're talking about why do we need to find this journey or something, one word popped into my mind, advertising. I mean, from a little, we have been bombarded with, you're not this, you're not enough, buy this, you'll be happy.
It's more than that. We're housed in separate bodies, and our nervous system tells us that there's an internal and external. This is not something that is entirely cultural.
Okay. Well, I was just going to say that the nature of growth itself is to differentiate, and why would our ego be any different than our biology, because it comes from us. And we're self-organizing creatures. Yeah. And so as our ego gets into the world and we're together, we self-organize, for example, around the Enneagram, because that's a consensus of something that came out. Those are 9 identifiable egos and how they approach the world, and evidently our world needed to self-organize around those. And so by studying that, then we can see our real self, because we see our differentiated self. So that's what I'm saying.
Okay, so another way, Betsy, what you say brought the image to mind of a tree. Each leaf is an individual leaf and looks at the other leaf and says, hey, there's the Paula leaf, you know, there's the Shirley leaf. But they're also the tree, right? They're the leaf and the tree. Anyway, let's go back to this. Okay.
The encounter with absolute consciousness, or identification with it, is not the only way to experience the supreme principle in the cosmos, or the ultimate reality. The second type of experience that seems to satisfy those who search for ultimate answers is particularly surprising, since it has no specific content. It is the identification with cosmic emptiness and nothingness, described in the mystical literature as the void. It is important to emphasize that not every experience of emptiness that we encounter in non-ordinary states qualifies as the void. People very often use this term to describe an unpleasant sense of lack of feeling. Initiative, or meaning. To deserve the name void, this state has to meet very specific criteria. So emptiness can mean either a lack, a hollowness, or it can mean this other thing. Capital E, emptiness, is this other thing. Capital V, void, is this other thing. When we encounter the void, we feel that it is primordial emptiness of cosmic proportions and relevance. We become pure, can you still hear me?
Yeah.
We become pure consciousness, aware of this absolute nothingness. However, at the same time, we have a strange paradoxical sense of its essential fullness. This cosmic vacuum is also a plenum, since nothing seems to be missing in it. While it does not contain anything in a concrete, manifest form, it seems to comprise all of existence in a potential form. In this paradoxical way, we can transcend the usual dichotomy between emptiness and form, or existence and non-existence. However, the possibility of such a resolution cannot be adequately conveyed in words. It has to be experienced to be understood. The void transcends the usual categories of time and space, is unchangeable, and lies beyond all dichotomies and polarities, such as light and darkness, good and evil, stability and motion, microcosm and macrocosm, agony and ecstasy, singularity and plurality, form and emptiness, and even existence and non-existence. Some people call it supracosmic and metacosmic, indicating that this primordial emptiness and nothingness appears to be the principle that underlies the phenomenal world as we know it, and is at the same time superordinated to it. This, so it's underneath and above. This metaphysical vacuum, pregnant with potential for everything there is, appears to be the cradle of all being, the ultimate source of existence. The creation of all phenomenal worlds is then the realization and concretation of its pre-existing potentialities. Again, the creation of all the phenomenal worlds is then the realization and concretation of its pre-existing potentialities. When we experience the void, we have a sense that while it is the source of all existence, it also contains all creation within itself. Another way of expressing it is to say that it is all of existence, since nothing exists outside of its realm. In terms of our usual concepts and logical norms, this seems to involve some basic contradictions. It would certainly seem absurd to think about emptiness as containing the world of phenomena, the essential characteristic of which seems to be that they have specific forms. Similarly, common sense is telling us that the creative principle and its creation cannot be the same thing, since they have to be different from each other. The extraordinary nature of the void transcends these paradoxes. So here we go. The following example is a description of the experience of the cosmic void of Christopher Bache, a philosopher of religion who has been involved for many years in a systematic spiritual quest. Chris Bache is a really amazing guy. He actually wrote a book called Dark Night, Early Dawn, about his spiritual quest. He's the most unlikely spiritual explorer. He's this Midwestern guy from Youngstown, Ohio, straight-laced, handsome, totally professorial, completely not hippie. But he wanted to know what he was reading. He's a professor of religion. He wanted to know what he was reading about, and he decided to find out. So, this is Chris Bache. By the way, when Groff uses the term void, he always capitalizes it. Suddenly, an enormous void opened up inside this world. Visually, it took the form of a warping of my visual field, as if a giant invisible bowl had been inserted into my seeing and was blending all the lines out to the outer edges of the picture. So his visual field is warping like a bowl. Nothing was torn or disrupted, but everything was being stretched and stopped to reveal this underlying reality. It was as if God suddenly paused between inhaling and exhaling, and the entire universe was suddenly suspended, not dissolved, but held in its place for an eternity. It was a gaping, yawning opening in existence. At first, this sensation took my breath away, both literally and figuratively, and I waited in suspension for movement to be restored. Okay. At first, this sensation took my breath away, both literally and figuratively, and I waited in suspension for movement to be restored. But movement was not restored. I was fully conscious, but absolutely suspended. And this suspension went on and on and on. I could not believe how long it lasted. As I soaked in this experience, I realized that this was the void out of which all form springs. It was the living stillness out of which all movement flows. The contentless experience of concentrated consciousness that was pre-form and outside form had to be what Indian philosophers called shunyata. When slowly movement resumed and the forms congealed, in the wake of the void came an exquisite sense of suchness. Fresh from the void, I touched the edges of experiencing existence just as it is. Some of you who have studied Zen have heard about suchness. experience just as it is. A little more. On several occasions, people who experience both the absolute consciousness, that is the light, and the void, have the insight that these two states are essentially identical and interchangeable. In spite of the fact that they can be experientially distinguished from each other, and that they might appear in spite of the fact that they can be experientially distinguished from each other, and that they might appear conceptually and logically incompatible. So, the light and the void. These experiences claim to have witnessed the emergence of creative cosmic consciousness from the void, or conversely, its return into the void and disappearance. So the light comes from the darkness and goes back to the darkness. Others experience these two aspects of the absolute simultaneously, identifying with the cosmic consciousness, that is the light, and at the same time recognizing its essential voidness. The experience of the void as a source of creation can also be associated with the recognition of the fundamental emptiness of the material world. The realization of the voidness of everyday reality is the core message of one of the most important spiritual texts of Mahayana Buddhism, the Prajnaparamita Hridaya Sutra, or the Heart of Perfect Wisdom Sutra. In the text, Avalokiteshvara addresses Buddha's disciple Shariputra. Quote, "The nature of form is emptiness. The nature of emptiness is form. Form is not different from emptiness. Emptiness is not different from form. Feelings, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness are also like this." I'm going to read a little more, but first I want to tell you about a parallel between the void and modern physics. I guess I can do this. You have to be careful because a lot of these books have written about the parallels between physics and consciousness. Aren't really either good physics or good consciousness. One thing I can talk about kind of for sure, and one thing I just know a little about. We perceive a physical world, but actually, if we could look more closely at the physical world, we would see that it is almost entirely not there. That is, that this solid stuff is a construction of our nervous systems when this stuff isn't solid. I don't remember the exact proportions, but Richard Feynman at Caltech used to give lectures to lecture halls of probably larger size than this, in which he would say, "You want a picture of the atom, kids? The atom is a bunch of electrons. He was physicalizing these things. Now we know that they're potentials, right? But anyway, you got a bunch of electrons zipping around at the periphery, two or three, depending on the atom, how many electrons, zipping around. And they're, I forget how big he said, they're like the size of a pinhead, something like that. And the nucleus of the atom is sitting here with me, and it's the size of a marble. And all the rest of this is empty space. So there's very, 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 very little substance in this planet. But the planet itself, okay, which is empty, I mean, it's almost, 99.999% empty, it's sitting in space. Now, when we go outside and look at the night sky, we see stars. But stars are little tiny clumps of matter in vast emptiness. We just don't, our nervous system just doesn't show us that what we're really looking at is the empty space. It's dark and empty. That's the nature of things. It's dark and empty, and there are these tiny little points of light. Now, how much substance is there? How many points of light are there? Or not how many points of light are there, but how much substance is there? So I did this calculation many times. I know it's true. Okay. You've probably heard me say it before, some of you. Here's the sun. It is the size of, it's an eighth of an inch in diameter. Okay, it's the size of a pinhead, a large pinhead, a small pinhead. So there's a pinhead. A foot away, at the size of a small grain of sand, such that you can almost not see it, is the Earth. Okay, so here's the sun, pinhead. Here's a foot away. Here's the Earth. The sun, as you know, is a glowing ball of gas. Okay. When you look out there at the other balls of gas, which are the size of a pinhead, okay, essentially, how far away are they? How far away is the closest star you can see on this scale of an eighth of an inch a foot? So the estimates are, you know, because we know it's really empty, so estimates are like 20 feet away, another pinhead, you know, or like 40 feet away, or like 100. Are you 100 yards away? Actually, the closest star we can see in the northern hemisphere, from this, on this scale, is in San Luis Obispo. It's another pinhead, it's 100 miles away. The absolute closest star, Proxima Centauri, is 4 light years away. That's only 50 miles away. Understand? So the point is, when we're looking out there, we're seeing incredible emptiness and tiny little points of light, and then when we look at the points of light, we're seeing that they're empty too. So what physics is telling us is that there's very little stuff in the universe at all, and that's old physics. New physics is there maybe is nothing at all there until you look. And then it appears and then goes away again. But I don't know too much about that. I don't want to get in a lot of trouble. Bernie.
Yeah, I read about this. It's kind of interesting. They said that if you were to take a hydrogen atom, you take a pinhead and you take a little marble in the middle of the Colosseum, and the pinhead would be going around the outside of the Colosseum. That's how much space it is. But the other thing is, they said if you took the Earth and you condensed it all down to solid matter, it'd be the size of a basketball.
Yeah, that's... Yeah, that's... But that one is less spectacular, you know, because you have a picture of basketball. Okay, so I need to read you a little bit more, okay? So on page 3839. Yeah. When we reach so what I told you just before is these two ways of looking at the ultimate principle, a light and creative energy of unimaginable proportions, and an emptiness which contains in potential form everything. So the light and the void. Okay. When we reach experiential identification with absolute consciousness, we realize that our own being is ultimately commensurate with the entire cosmic network, with all of existence. The recognition of our own divine nature, our identity with the cosmic source, is the most important discovery we can make during the process of deep self-exploration. This is the essence of the famous statement found in the ancient Indian scriptures, the Upanishads. Tat Tvam Asi, the literal translation, the literal translation of this sentence is, thou art that, meaning you are of divine nature or you are the Godhead. It reveals that our everyday identification with the skin-encapsulated ego, embodied individual consciousness, or name and form, is an illusion, and that our true nature is that of cosmic creative energy, Atman Brahman. This revelation concerning the identity of the individual with the divine is the ultimate secret that lies at the core of all the great spiritual traditions, although it might be expressed in somewhat different ways. I have already mentioned that in Hinduism, Atman, the individual consciousness, and Brahman, the universal consciousness, are one. The followers of Siddha Yoga here in many variations, the basic tenet of their school, God dwells within you as you. In Buddhist scriptures, we can read, look within, you are the Buddha. In the Confucian tradition, we are told that heaven, earth, and the human are one body. The same message can be found in the words of Jesus, Father, you and I are one. And St. Gregory Palamas, one of the greatest theologians of the Christian Orthodox Church, declared, for the kingdom of heaven, nay, rather the King of heaven, is within us. Similarly, the great Jewish sage and Kabbalist, Avraham ben Shmuel Abulafia, taught that he and we are one. According to Muhammad, whosoever knoweth himself knoweth his Lord. Mansur al-Halaj, the Sufi ecstatic and poet, known as the martyr of mystical love, described it this way. I saw my Lord with the eye of the heart. I said, who art thou? He answered, thou. Al-Halaj was imprisoned and sentenced to death for his statement, Anal Haq, I am God, the absolute truth, the true reality. We can now summarize the insights from holotropic states of consciousness concerning the creative principle, the nature of reality, and our own nature. As we have seen, these insights echo the message of the great spiritual traditions of the world. They suggest that the world of solid matter, featuring three-dimensional space, linear time, and unrelenting causality as we experience it in our ordinary states of consciousness, does not have an independent existence. They suggest that the world of solid matter does not have an independent existence of its own. Rather than being the only true reality as is portrayed by materialistic science, it is a creation of absolute consciousness. In the light of these insights, the material world of our everyday life, including our own body, is an intricate tissue of misperceptions and misreadings. It is a playful and somewhat arbitrary product of the cosmic creative principle, an infinitely sophisticated virtual reality, a divine play created by absolute consciousness and the cosmic void. Our universe that appears to contain myriads of separate entities and elements is in its deepest nature just one being of immense proportions and unimaginable complexity.
I have more to read, but is there a comment or question about, or sort of this question, but is there a comment about this before I read more from a different source? Peter.
We are all one.
It's what seems to be being stated here by modern consciousness research and by ancient understanding. Chris.
And the creative source, I see, has a way to play through fractals by showing us it's repeated everywhere. The human body, in fact, and then you go into the brain or the DNA. It's a repeat of the cosmos. It is. Okay. It's a cosmic game.
Yeah. Abraham. Okay.
Yeah, you know, the way I look at reality, you know, when I was going to school, I was making holograms in the laser laboratory at the university. And I thought of the reality that we have is a projection of a hologram in our brain. Because we are part of that physical existence,
right.
Then we collide with the objects that we meet in that particular hologram. Where we are outside of that hologram, like in the laboratory, our hands will go through the objects without being touched.
Right, yeah, yeah.
So, to me, you know, reality is just, it's an image of a hologram in our brain, as long as we maintain that physical existence. And then when we die and get out of that physical existence, then we see it as in a table.
Yeah.
In the laser laboratory, yeah. Where the objects are sitting there, and our hand goes through, we look from the plane, yeah. From this, and project the laser, and we see our hands going through the objects without touching them, because they're only an image.
So this idea of reality being holographic, yeah. Has been written about a bunch. Carl Prebrum talked about this, the neuroscientist talked about this, and a bunch of other people have talked about the holographic nature of reality. In fact, one of Stan Grof's books, Beyond the Brain, talks about it at some length. So let me read you a little more, okay? Because I have a little more time. Okay. I'm not going to get to very much of this, but... the question comes up, well, how do we realize this? How do we get there? So the various answers to that question have arisen. I'll read a few of them.
Which book is this?
So I just changed books. So the book I'm not going to read to you from now, because it's a long explication, is from Coming Home. I'm going to talk about it again, probably in the fall. I'll talk about the Zen Oxfording pictures. And kind of, I have a new understanding of them, so I'll present that. But that's a long, that's a long class in itself. So this is from Zigzag Zen, second edition. Very beautiful book with wonderful graphics. And surprisingly, I didn't read this in the first edition. I only read it last summer. Because it's supposedly about putting together Buddhism and psychedelic insights, and I kind of thought it was going to be hokey, but it's actually filled with really, really, really good essays. So this is Jack Kornfield. So he's talking about traditional Buddhist practice, which is a way to realize these truths. You traditionally begin with sila, or compassionate action. This commitment to not cause harm is the foundation upon which all spiritual life is built. It is universally understood that you can't meditate properly after a day of lying and stealing. To free the heart from entanglement, okay, to free the heart. Now, Jack talks about the heart. Oh, I got to say one thing, which is another way that people talk about the basic principle in the universe is they talk about a basic love. This is a little bit, what I've read to you is a little bit cerebral. And so Jack is the teacher that most talks about the heart as being the thing that causes the realization, as opposed to the mind. And in fact, in Buddhism, the heart and the mind are the heart-mind. But Jack emphasizes the heart. Okay? So we're talking about the first step in spiritual realization is compassionate action. To free the heart from entanglement in things that Buddhism talks about as the things that blind us, greed, fear, hatred, and delusion, a non-violent relationship with the world must be developed. Out of this ground of compassionate conduct grows the whole range of other meditative and spiritual practices. So step one is be kind and considerate. By living a compassionate and harmonious life, you have already begun to quiet the mind and open the heart. Then the second domain is to train your heart through meditations, visualizations, and yogic practices that tame the wild monkey mind. It is the power of these practices that dissolve the barriers of the mind, the identification with our small sense of self. They unify our body, heart, and mind through concentration and open us to the vast inner realms.
So the second thing you do after you're living a compassionate, harmonious life is you engage in meditative and other spiritual practices which quiet the mind and open the heart and dissolve the artificial barriers that the mind creates. The third domain is the arising of wisdom or prajna. Based on a foundation of compassionate living and meditative training, consciousness becomes clear and open. Wisdom arises as we see the whole nature of how consciousness creates the world and discover freedom and the great heart of a Buddha in the midst of it all. With this foundation of wise conduct and inner training, you have a context for the deepest wisdom, and it's naturally integrated in your life. Beautiful statement. Good, I found a little more. This is Jack Kornfield still. The point is to awaken to our natural inner freedom, our true nature. To do this, we must start where we are. In the beginning, to quiet the mind and open the heart, you often encounter waves of desire, fear, anger, laziness, or restlessness. These are the preliminary hindrances to transformation. You learn how to use wise attention so you don't become caught up or lost in them. As your body and, were I to put any sentence in this interview in capitals, it would be that spiritual awakening is not just about visiting the many realms of heart, mind, and body, but learning how to relate to their content wisely, compassionately, and with real freedom. On the subject of vision, so now you're thinking, I want to go out and have this vision of ultimate reality, right? On the subject of visions, one of my teachers, Achen Cha, taught, quote, "Though they have come about, do not take them seriously. Do not take anything as yourself. Everything is only a vision or construction of the mind, a deception that causes you to desire, grasp, or fear. When you see such constructions, do not get involved. All unusual experiences and visions are of value to the wise person, but harmful to the unwise. Keep practicing until you are not stirred by them." One more quote, and then I'll say one last thing. Healing takes place in a number of ways. But the most fundamental healing in Buddhist practice comes by bringing awareness to that which was twisted, knotted, or held in darkness in the body. Okay, I'll do it again because I'm not focused. Healing takes place in a number of ways, but the most fundamental healing in Buddhist practice comes by bringing awareness to that which was twisted, knotted, or held in darkness in the body, feelings, or mind. Through systematic meditation practice, one brings the power of compassion and mindfulness to these knots, and the deepest patterns of holding open up. Without even doing a physical yoga, through sitting meditation, the deepest body release can occur. There are many patterns of mind in which we get entangled: beliefs, opinions, and views. All that leads us to hold on to our sense of self as separate. These two can be opened and healed. And then the last comment I want to make is, if a Zen master were sitting listening to all this, she or he would probably bow and say, "Nonsense." Understand, every To a pure Zen person, everything you experience is a mental construction. It's all made out of consciousness. And the minute you construct something in consciousness, you make it different than every other aspect of consciousness. And the great realization is that it's all one thing. And so the minute you try to make it a thing, you lose. You separate it. And the fundamental thing that we make in making all these things is us. Me separate than it, than you. And the spiritual path, the path of psychological healing and growth and spiritual realization is the making more permeable the separation between yourself, other people, and the world. It's not that you don't have a self. It's that the self is no longer a barrier. It's just a convenient perspective. All right. If this was a little bit ethereal, next week we're coming back down to earth, big time. Oh, Jeanette, okay, I guess there's one question or comment. Jeanette?
So I'm hearing two things. I hear that reality is a mental construct, but then I hear the heart, that if there's deception, and that we should avoid certain things. Did I understand that right?
Believing in any construct will keep you from seeing the truth. That's what Ajahn Chah said. He said, when you notice anything, you acknowledge it, but you don't buy it. All right, I'll see you next week.